book is mostly about business, excellence through care and attention to each other and to our customers and to our communities also turns out to be a profit builder and profit sustainer and job maintainer or creator of surpassing importance, especially in these uncertain times. 2.12. The 18 E's of excellence. Exuberance. Vibrate. Cause earthquakes. Energy. Be fire. Light fires. Execution. Do it. Now. Get it done. Empowerment. Respect and appreciation. Always ask, what do you think? Then listen, liberate, celebrate. 100% innovators or bust. Edginess. Perpetually dance at the frontier and a little or a lot beyond. Enraged. Be determined to challenge and change the status quo. Engaged. Be addicted to managing by wandering around. In touch. Always. Electronic. Partners with the world 60-60, 24-7, 365, via electronic community building and entanglement of every sort, crowdsourcing, crowd-doing power. Encompassing. Relentlessly pursue diverse opinions. The more diversity, the merrier. Diversity works. Emotion. The alpha, the omega, the essence of leadership, the essence of sales, the essence of marketing. The essence, period. Acknowledge it. Empathy. Connect, connect, connect with others' realities and aspirations. Walk in the other person's shoes until the souls have holes. Experience. Life is theater. Make every activity memorable. For example, aim for the Steve Jobs measure. Insanely great. Experimental. Ready, fire, aim. Whoever tries the most stuff wins. Error prone. Fail faster, succeed sooner. If you try a lot of stuff, you will screw a lot of stuff up along the way. It's a necessary and applause-worthy part of the process. Even-handed. Fair to a fault, honest as Abe. Expectations. Michelangelo. The greatest danger for most of us is not that our aim is too high and we miss it, but that it is too low and we reach it. Amen. Eudaimonia. Pursue the highest of human moral purpose. The core of Aristotle's philosophy. Be of service. Always. Excellence, the only standard. 2.13. Excellence, always. Excellence, always. If not excellence, what? If not excellence now, when? 2.14. Excellence, above and beyond. Excellence can be obtained if you care more than others think is wise, risk more than others think is safe, dream more than others think is practical, expect more than others think is possible. K. Sriram posted at tompeters.com. 3. Culture, the sine qua non. My story. It was war. Total war, and that's total nonsense, though it felt like that to me at the time. It was 1977, and McKinsey's managing director, Ron Daniel, felt that his preeminent institution was under attack from the Boston Consulting Group in particular. McKinsey was beyond doubt pick of the litter as counselors to top management. Some argued that McKinsey shaped American business and, increasingly, business around the world. But BCG was offering a well-formed body of concepts. McKinsey's stars were counselors to top management. BCG's stars were the idea people who prepared companies for tomorrow. Daniel wanted to maintain the role of preeminent counselors, but also wanted to get into the ideas arena fast. And in fact, McKinsey's intellectual horsepower was a match for BCG's. Daniel launched two big projects headed by senior power players out of the New York office, one on creating winning strategies, the other on operations systems that maximized efficiency in a client's businesses. But Daniel also had a personal itch to scratch. He had noticed over the years that McKinsey provided sound advice to its clients, but far too often the grand plans failed the implementation test. Hence, he decided to launch a low-power, mostly beneath the radar, third IDEAS project on organizational effectiveness. I was a juniorish McKinsey non-partner with a good, albeit brief, track record in the quote-unquote crazy San Francisco office. Of particular interest to Daniel, I had recently received my PhD from Stanford in organization effectiveness. Bottom line, to my surprise, the project landed on my desk, and I was assigned a guiding partner, Bob Waterman, who 5 years later became the co-author of In Search of Excellence. To launch the project, I was in effect given an unlimited travel budget to roam the world, particularly the academic world, in pursuit of the best and most progressive and provocative thinking on organizational effectiveness. My roaming took about 6 months, and my frequent flyer miles totaled in the tens of thousands. I did pretty much visit everybody who mattered, including soon-to-be Nobel laureate Herb Simon at Carnegie Mellon University. Frankly, what I found mirrored the intellectual strains that had fueled my PhD work. One of my mentors had been Jim March, who had come to Stanford from Carnegie Mellon and who had been Dr. Simon's principal partner for decades. To make a long story short, my findings were greatly at odds with the McKinsey canon, as they didn't involve mathematical formulas or other quant tricks. I concluded that what makes an organization fly was derisively called by my McKinsey peers, quote, the soft stuff, unquote. For example, the non-linear people stuff. And I also discovered the importance of what is now called corporate culture. That term did not exist in 1977. Its precursors were labeled the informal organization, management style, the way we do things around here, and the like. My presentations to McKinsey grandees were mostly met with indifference. However, I was building a network of renegades inside the firm, and those renegades were introducing me to their clients who were intrigued by the concepts I had collected. The clients knew that what McKinseyites considered secondary, the messy implementation bit, was indeed the difference between winning and losing. As I gained traction, McKinsey traditionalists fought back. Through my network, I managed to get an op-ed published in the Wall Street Journal that was all about the impact of corporate culture on business results and, implicitly, pretty explicitly to be honest, downgraded the role of strategy. I was told that the head of the New York office actually went to Daniel in an effort to get me fired over my heretical 800 words. But Daniel remained steadfast. In fact, such controversy and publicity around McKinsey ideas was exactly what he had been looking for. Time passed, and a McKinsey German office renegade, Herb Hensler, got funds from his client, Siemens, to sponsor another round-the-world trip. This one focused on corporations, not academic institutions, and the goal was to unearth the secrets of the world's top companies. The findings were published internally in 1979, and the lead role went to that soft stuff, in particular, corporate culture. The hard-soft war continued to rage, and, frankly, about half of McKinsey was outwardly distressed by the publication of In Search of Excellence in October of 1982. The good news for the resistors was that the publisher had low expectations, and the first print run was a meager 5,000. The bad news for the resistors was that a year later, that publisher journeyed to Palo Alto to host Bob Waterman and me at a party commemorating the sale of the book's 1 millionth copy. The soft guys had prevailed, or at least gained a significant toehold, and the likes of corporate culture had made its way into the big leagues of business ideas. The transition was slow, but some people say that at modern-day McKinsey, a large share, maybe even half, of total revenue is at least indirectly tied to what's called the organization effectiveness practice and its offspring. The culture narrative. 3.1.1. Culture is the game. No one at McKinsey was more dismissive of the soft stuff I was championing than senior partner Lou Gerstner. Lou was tougher than tough as nails, outspoken, and a strategist's strategist. Get the strategy right and you're three-quarters of the way down the road. That was his view. He eventually left McKinsey and went to top jobs at American Express, and then became CEO of RJR Nabisco. But there was another chapter to go. Big Blue. IBM in the 70s and 80s was the iconic American company. As the 80s wound down, the company became flabby, missed many opportunities, and ended up in severe trouble. In a last-gasp effort to return the firm to its glory, IBM's board called in Gerstner in 1993 to fix the mess. And fix it he did. At the end of his 9-year stint, IBM was once again riding high and well-prepared for the years ahead. Gerstner recounted his chapter of IBM history in his 2002 book, Who Says Elephants Can't Dance? Inside IBM's Historic Turnaround. He reports at one point on what he called his premier lesson learned. If I could have chosen not to tackle the IBM culture head on, I probably wouldn't have. My bias coming in was towards strategy, analysis, and measurement. In comparison, changing the attitude and behaviors of hundreds of thousands of people is very, very hard. Yet I came to see in my time at IBM that culture isn't just one aspect of the game, it is the game. Gerstner, culture, it is the game. Indeed it is. Throughout this book, the word culture will appear many times. I'll talk about a key notion, such as in the initial innovation chapter, the importance of running a zillion rapid experiments in parallel. I'll write something like the following. The idea of constant innovation as a byproduct of trying stuff fast is far, far easier said than done. To make it work, one needs no less than a try-it culture, deeply embedded in the company's psyche. This or that big idea, in fact, is virtually meaningless and certainly not sustainable without a supporting and encompassing culture umbrella. 3.1.2. Culture matters most. Affirmations. 1. Ed Schein, MIT professor, generally considered the founder of the culture movement. Culture eats strategy for breakfast. 2. Wall Street Journal, 2013, interview. Reporter, what matters most to a company over time, strategy or culture? Dominic Barton, Managing Director, McKinsey & Company, culture. That is a long way from McKinsey's resistance to the culture notion as described in the chapter's opening vignette. 3. Culture is the game even when the game is football. Hall of Fame NFL coach Bill Walsh inherited a horrible San Francisco 49ers team in 1979. Though expectations were sky high, in his first year there was no improvement in the won and loss record. Year before Walsh arrived, 2 wins, 14 losses. Walsh's first year, 2 wins, 14 losses. Why no instant turnaround? Walsh reports in his book, The Score Takes Care of Itself, that he spent the first year working on culture. Yes, on a football team. He explained, the culture precedes positive results. It doesn't get tacked on as an afterthought on your way to the victory stand. During that first year, Coach Walsh reports that he worked on establishing an ethos of professionalism, decorum, support for one's teammates, and the like. The first year's result was that 2 wins, 14 losses record, but a scant 2 years later, in 1982, the 49ers won the Super Bowl with a record of 17 wins, 2 losses. 3.2. A CEO's life. An enduring obsession with culture. Coming out of the above is my uncompromising CEO's first commandment. CEO job one is setting and micro-nourishing 1 day, 1 hour, 1 minute at a time, an effective, people truly first, innovate or die, excellence or bust corporate culture. The key words in my declaration are 1 day, 1 hour, 1 minute at a time. Culture is the chief's obsession or it's pretty much nothing at all. Culture is shaped by the casual comment the boss makes to the receptionist as she walks through the door in the morning. Culture is shaped by 3 casual comments, no more than 30 seconds each, that the boss makes as she walks the 25 yards from the receptionist's desk to her office. Culture is shaped dramatically by the tone and quality and care put into the 6 emails the boss responds to in the 15 minutes after she gets to her desk. Culture is shaped by every twitch and blink and comment the boss makes at the morning meeting. The rules. Culture comes first. Culture is exceedingly difficult to change. Culture change cannot be, must not be, evaded or avoided. Culture maintenance is about as difficult as culture change. Culture maintenance, 1 day, 1 hour, 1 minute at a time. Culture change and culture maintenance must become a conscious, permanent, personal agenda item. Culture change and culture maintenance is manifest in the little things far more than in the big things. Repeat, culture change, culture maintenance. 1 day, 1 hour, 1 minute at a time. Forever and ever. Amen. 3.3. Culture is a clean shoelace. From Leonard Berry and Kent Seltman, Orchestrating the Clues of Quality, Chapter 7, Management Lessons from Mayo Clinic. Mayo Rochester employee Mary Ann Morris, the administrator of general service in the Office of Patient Affairs, often tells a story about her early days with the organization. She was working in a laboratory, a job that required her to wear a white uniform and white shoes. And after a hectic morning getting her 2 small children to school, she arrived at work to find her supervisor staring at her shoes. The supervisor had noticed that the laces were dirty where they threaded through the eyelets of Morris's shoes and asked Morris to clean them. Offended, Morris said that she worked in a laboratory, not with patients, so why should it matter? Her boss replied that Morris had contact with patients in ways that she didn't recognize, going out on the street wearing her Mayo name tag, for instance, or passing by patients and their families as she walked through the halls, and that she couldn't represent Mayo Clinic with dirty shoelaces. Though I was initially offended, I realized over time that everything I do, down to my shoelaces, represents my commitment to our patients and visitors. I still use the dirty shoelace story to set the standard for the service level I aspire to for myself and my co-workers. Mayo is routinely voted the best healthcare provider in the United States. Elements of its distinctive team medicine practice, its culture, are described in Chapter 1. 3.4.1 Culture Plus. Hard is soft, soft is hard. It is only a slight exaggeration to say that you can summarize In Search of Excellence in 6 words. Hard is soft, soft is hard. Hard, numbers and plans, is soft. Plans are often fantasies and numbers are readily manipulated. Case in point, quants and rating agency staffers cleverly packaged and evaluated derivatives of valueless mortgages, thus spurring the multi-trillion-dollar financial crash of 2007-2008 plus. Soft, people, relationships, culture, is hard. Difficult to achieve, and enduring only if incessantly worked at. While I hardly dismiss the traditionally emphasized hard stuff, I do insist that the soft stuff is the key to long-term success and the bedrock of excellence. I'm a certified numbers guy. I have no less than 4 quant degrees, 2 in engineering, 2 in business. The Excellence Book co-author, Bob Waterman, also has a quants education. An engineering degree, a business degree. In the opening story in Chapter 1, I recounted my experience as a combat engineer in Vietnam. I arrived in country with civil engineering tools aplenty, but I was soon given a detachment to command in a rather unpleasant setting. Overnight, I discovered that 99% of my concerns were people concerns, so-called, mistakenly called, soft concerns. And I was totally unprepared for the soft stuff leadership in a setting where bad guys were shooting at us and the roads were intensively mined. Long-term result from that harsh introduction to managerial life, my life's work. Hard is soft, soft is hard. 3.4.2. Hard is soft, soft is hard. The McKinsey 7S model. The 7 S's. Strategy, structure, systems, style, skills, staff, shared values. The commonly emphasized hard S's. Strategy, structure, systems. The frequently ignored and almost always undervalued soft S's. Style, the way we do things around here, corporate culture. Skills, distinctive competency or competencies. Staff, people. Shared values, the bedrock of sustained superior performance. The McKinsey 7S model that Bob Waterman and I developed in 1979 with Tony Athos, Richard Pascal, and Julian Phillips has stood the test of time, 39 years to date. McKinsey eventually accepted the 7S's as nearly holy writ. The firm's managing director in the 1990s claimed that the model remains the most useful framework for assessing organizational effectiveness. The idea, encompassed by the hard is soft, soft is hard notion, and expanded via the full framework, is that there are soft S's as well as hard S's that must be considered and managed to maximize organization well-being and competitive strength. And, historically, those soft S's have sat in the back row if they were invited at all. The real trick is not ceding the front row to the soft S's. It is balance. Equal attention to all the elements. In fact, the magic on top of the magic is achieving sustainable success by getting the balance among the S's right according to the needs of the times. And that requires a master conductor with perfect pitch. 90 years ago, the fabled General Motors chief, Alfred Sloan, the iconic CEO of the times, said his key to effectiveness was constantly rejiggering the balance between centralization, hard, firm hand on the tiller, and decentralization, soft, allowing 100 flowers to bloom. At times, he said, you needed tight controls, and at other times, the division general managers, Chevrolet, Cadillac, etc., needed to be given free rein. So too with implementing a 7S approach. 3.4.3. Note on hard stuff and numbers, metrics in particular. I am not averse to or an enemy of hard stuff. Take numbers. For better or for worse, I think and dream numerically. The point here is not to dismiss numbers. It is that numbers should not be the default tail that wags the dog. Numbers are abstractions. Numbers are derivative of real action. Soft relationships, on the other hand, bleed real blood. Numbers matter, a lot. But business by the numbers is a loser's delusion. Yes, even in the age of big data and the like. Few have said all this better than the pollster Daniel Yankelovich, quoted in Jack Bogle's book, Enough, on the limitations of analytic models. The first step is to measure what can easily be measured. This is okay as far as it goes. The second step is to disregard that which cannot be measured or give it an arbitrary quantitative value. This is artificial and misleading. The third step is to presume that what cannot be measured is not very important. This is blindness. The fourth step is to say what cannot be measured does not really exist. This is suicide. My comment? Amen. 3.4.4. The soft edge, lining the path to sustained success in Silicon Valley 2. Forbes publisher and Silicon Valley stalwart Rich Karlgaard has long been a keen observer of the forces reshaping the technology powerhouses that now drive much of the economy. He encompassed his assessment of the factors determining success and failure in his 2014 book, The Soft Edge, Where Great Companies Find Lasting Success. Here's the heart of Karlgaard's argument. I believe the business world is at a crossroads where hard-edged people are dominating the narrative and discussion. The battle for money and attention boiling inside most companies and among most managers is that between the hard and soft edges. Far too many companies invest too little time and money in their soft edge excellence. This mistake has three main reasons. The hard edge is easier to quantify. Successful hard edge investment provides a faster ROI. CEOs, CFOs, COOs, boards of directors, and shareholders speak the language of finance. Let me make the case, Karlgaard continues, for investing time and money in your company's soft edge. Soft edge strength leads to greater brand recognition, higher profit margins. It is the ticket out of Commodityville. Companies strong in the soft edge are better prepared to survive a big strategic mistake or cataclysmic disruption. Hard edge strength is absolutely necessary to stay alive and compete, but it provides a fleeting advantage. A rather imposing list of benefits, eh? With all due respect to In Search of Excellence, I think Karlgaard's hard-soft assessment here is by far the best I've ever come across. To give you a flavor of how Karlgaard fleshed out his argument, consider the major soft section titles from The Soft Edge. Trust, Teams, Taste, Smarts, Story. The book's examples range far and wide, well beyond high tech in Silicon Valley. Nonetheless, much of the power of the book, for me, comes from its Silicon Valley roots. Think Silicon Valley, and the words that come to mind are engineering, coding, software, algorithms, the cloud, and big data. That is, the hardest of the hard stuff. Yet Karlgaard convincingly argues that the winners, even or maybe even especially in the Valley, are those who are most effective at assimilating the other side of the coin. That soft stuff, as it were. It is a powerful message. The book, incidentally, gets my vote as top business book of the decade to date. God alone knows how many copies I've given away or how many casualties I have caused by whacking people over the head with the hardcover version. 3.4.5. The Soft Edge. Liberal arts thinking comes to the Valley. As illustration of the above, consider this unlikely cover story in Forbes in July 2015. The new golden ticket. You don't have to code to get rich. How liberal arts grads are conquering Silicon Valley. Highlights. Revenge of the philosophy majors. In Silicon Valley, brilliant coding and engineering is a given. The real value added, increasingly, comes from the people who can sell and humanize, which is why tech startups suddenly crave liberal arts majors. It's one of the most glistening of tech's 10-digit unicorn startups, boasting 1.1 million users and a private market valuation of $2.8 billion. If you've used Slack's team-based messaging software, you know that one of its catchiest innovations is Slackbot, a helpful little avatar that pops up periodically to provide tips so jaunty that it seems human. Such creativity cannot be programmed. Instead, much of it is minted by one of Slack's 180 employees, Anna Picard, the 38-year-old editorial director. She earned a theater degree from Britain's Manchester Metropolitan University before discovering that she hated the constant snubs of auditions that didn't work out. After winning acclaim for her blogging, video game writing, and cat impersonations, she found her way into tech, where she cooks up zany replies to users who type in, "I love you, Slackbot." It's her mission, Picard explains, to provide users with extra bits of surprise and delight. The pay is good, the stock options even better. One cover story is not a trend. On the other hand, it does suggest the growing awareness of soft is hard, the importance of the soft edge in a very unlikely locale. 3.4.6, the soft stuff beneath them. In The Advantage, Why Organizational Health Trumps Everything Else in Business, author Patrick Lencioni recounts a revealing incident. As I sat there at the conference, listening to one presentation after another, highlighting the remarkable and unorthodox activities, people first dogma, leadership style, communal culture, etc., that have made this organization so healthy, I leaned over and asked the CEO a semi-rhetorical question. Why in the world don't your competitors do any of this? After a few seconds, he whispered, almost sadly, "You know, I honestly believe they think it's beneath them." Wow, and it surely squares with my decades of enterprise observation. 3.4.7, final hard, soft thought. Security through the soft stuff? The tech tsunami and the possible, probable, jobs apocalypse that most likely will accompany it. How does one fight back, or, far better yet, get ahead of the curve? In my considered opinion, the best avenue, maybe the only effective avenue, is likely through emphasizing the soft stuff. For example, culture, people, obsessive listening, innovation via most failures wins, differentiation through insanely great design, and always an abiding commitment to 1 hour at a time, 5 minutes at a time, no less than excellence. There are certainly no guarantees, but there are promising paths worth exploring, and there are exemplars to inspire us. Chapter 4. The Trailblazers, Small and Medium-Sized Enterprises. My story. A sea anchor is also known as a drift anchor, drift sock, para anchor, or boat brake, and is a device used to stabilize a boat in heavy weather. Rather than tethering the boat to the sea floor, the sea anchor increases the drag through the water and thus acts as a brake. It can also be attached to the stern of a vessel, preventing the ship from turning broadside to the waves. My wife and I typically spend North America's winter months on the other end of the globe in New Zealand, at the top of the South, as in South Island. We have a small cottage by the Tasman Sea. About 25 miles away is the tiny town of Motueka. On the main street of Motueka, you will find a nondescript door leading to the operations office and factory of W.A. Coppens, which by most accounts is the global leader in designing and building sea anchors and related products. With roots going back to textile design and production in 1896, today Coppens thrives on what the company's chief calls wicked problems. Its products range from light recreational gear to monster systems for premier clients such as the United States Navy and the government of Norway. I admit it, I'm in love with W.A. Coppens and others of their ilk. Coppens et al. Are category killers, to use the retail term, that through unbridled imagination and excellence dominate a niche market, often globally, often from out-of-the-way places like Motueka. Companies like W.A. Coppens and somewhat larger firms, which come under the heading of SMEs, small and medium-sized enterprises, are the secret backbone, as one wag puts it, of every economy, whether Kiwi, GDP approximately $200 billion, or American, GDP of $17 trillion. Backbone as in, one, chief source of innovation, and two, chief source of employment and job creation, especially important in the face of the technology upheaval we are facing. In 2014, I gave a keynote speech to the premier annual business government conference in New Zealand. I ruffled more than a few feathers when I said that the Kiwis need to birth and nurture in any way possible their Coppenses, rather than overdepend, as they traditionally have, on volatile commodities. Powdered milk for baby formula for the Chinese market is the country's export mainstay these days. Talk about precarious. One spoiled shipload and watch national export dollars take the deepest dive. As I said, feathers were ruffled, which was my unabashed goal. Oh my, I do indeed love those global, niche, dominating, mighty magicians of Motueka, W.A. Coppens. Bravo. 100 times over. Bravo. Coppens, not so incidentally, is supported by two mighty magician partners. Its Sea Anchor product base is a form of nylon, Dyneema, developed and produced by specialist DSM Netherlands. And Coppens relies upon custom-made fabric from another modest size specialist, W. Wiggins of neighboring Wellington. Such combinations of small superstars are not uncommon and support the notion that national success is boosted enormously by a dynamic, self-reinforcing SME ecosystem. The Coppenses are everywhere, though you'd not know it from the monster firm-obsessed business guru literature. I do not deny my own guilt or business school curricula. My goal in this chapter is threefold. First, to make it clear in New Zealand and Germany and the United States and elsewhere that winners like W.A. Coppens deserve our standing ovation and strong private and public support for their economic contributions to their country and their communities, and especially for the millions upon millions of good jobs they create and maintain. Second, to also make it clear that there are stellar role models in every nook and cranny in the economy. Sometimes it seems as though the likes of Silicon Valley code kings and app creators are grabbing all of our attention, when in fact we should be searching for sea anchor kings who groove on wicked problems. Third, that the Coppenses and their ilk are where you should be looking for the purest manifestations of business excellence, offering lessons to learn by the bushel. So let's up sea anchor and look at the bigger story. The SME narrative. 4.1. Unlikely superstars. Coppens Plus. I do love sea anchor business excellence. Where should we look next? From underwater to underhouse? 4.1.1. The Dry Basement Kings. Basement Systems, Inc. All things basementy. Basement Systems, Inc. of Seymour, Connecticut, is primarily in the business of getting mold and dampness out of basements. Your home's once foul and perhaps poisonous, but now rejuvenated lower reaches, become fit for storage or use as a family room or extra bedroom. That is, effectively adding a room to your house. No small thing, eh? Basement improvement. What a dreary business. Not to Larry Janeski. For Larry J. and his spirited crew, basements rock. Among many other things, Janeski codified his activities, all things basementy, and the value thereof in his book, Dry Basement Science, which sold over 100,000 copies. He also holds over 25 patents. Started in 1986, the fast-growing company has at last looked 400 dealers in six countries, and revenue exceeds $100 million. Basement Systems is also a consistent prize winner, local, state, national, in categories such as Best Places to Work, Best Small Business, and Entrepreneur of the Year. The company is a paragon on just about any dimension you can name. 4.1.2. How about the garage? 1111 Lincoln Road. In his superb book, Simply Brilliant, How Great Organizations Do Ordinary Things in Extraordinary Ways, Bill Taylor takes us, among other places, to Miami Beach, and, more specifically, 1111 Lincoln Road. That address has become a Miami Beach landmark. For example, LeBron James, then with the Miami Heat and arguably the world's best basketball player, introduced his 11th Nike shoe, celebrated with hoopla of the first order at 1111 Lincoln Road. So just what is this address? A 300-car parking garage. Developer Robert Wennett wanted to reintroduce the original 1920 vision of Lincoln Road, as he put it. Among many other things, that meant having a makeover designed by the world-renowned Swiss architects Herzog and de Meuron. The product of that makeover amounted to, per one member of the press, carkitecture, unimaginable marriage of high-end architecture and car storage. 1111 Lincoln features, among many other things, public art in a grand staircase. Joggers by the score work out there every morning. Many of them then move on to in-garage yoga classes. Wennett calls it a curated space which provides an experience telling a story. Wennett himself lives in the penthouse at the top of the garage. Is this over the top? Of course. But it is also a very profitable venture, a community changer, and a peerless act of imagination. Simply Brilliant features a bushel or two of such inspiring examples. 4.1.3 Jim's Group, Australia's star at things customers don't want to do themselves. Jim Penman started Jim's Mowing in 1984. He was getting a PhD in cross-cultural anthropology and paid his rent via mowing lawns on the side. By the mid-2010s, his one-man, one-more firm had grown to Jim's Group, with over 3,600 franchisees in Australia, New Zealand, the United Kingdom, and Canada. His avowed bread and butter, as the section suggests, quote, things that customers don't want to do themselves, unquote. Category killers, a sampler. Jim's Mowing, Canada. Jim's Mowing, UK. Jim's Antennas. Jim's Bookkeeping. Jim's Building Maintenance. Jim's Carpet Cleaning. Jim's Car Cleaning. Jim's Computer Services. Jim's Dog Wash. Jim's Driving School. Jim's Fencing. Jim's Floors. Jim's Painting. Jim's Paving. Jim's Pergolas. Jim's Pool Care. Jim's Pressure Cleaning. Jim's Roofing. Jim's Security Doors. Jim's Trees. Jim's Window Cleaning, Jim's Windscreens, and so on and so on and on. Like Larry Janeski in Dry Basement Science, Jim Penman also gave us a book recounting his journey. What Will They Franchise Next? The Story of Jim's Group. Coppins Basement Systems, Inc., 1111 Lincoln Road, and Jim's Group are illustrative of the best of the all-important SME, small and medium-sized enterprise sector, and the best where you'd least expect it, a long, long way from Palo Alto. Nope, you'd never know about the SME economic dominance from reading guru literature or checking out a typical business school course list. The gurus, the business schools, and the national press focus on the big guys almost exclusively. That's a bad idea. First, because there are so many great SMEs and so many fascinating places doing fascinating things that we can learn from. Second, and equally important, it is not clear how much those vaunted big guys have to teach us. Frankly, their long-term performance is questionable, and that's an understatement. 4.2. Let's back up and restart this chapter's story with a brief assessment of the wobbly big guys. What follows amounts to a solid case, but is hardly the stuff of an Oxford economics dissertation. There are superb giant firms. For heaven's sakes, that was the whole point of my first book, In Search of Excellence. And we can learn from them. But the excellence edge is devilishly hard to maintain. Overall, our companies have done surprisingly well in financial terms, but a significant share of the search superstars have lost much of their sparkle in the 36 years since the book was published. In the end, the giant's contribution to the economy is grossly exaggerated, especially when it comes to employment, job creation, and innovation. Moreover, the big guy's long-term performance as a whole stinks, and typical efforts to make a comeback via, say, mergers and acquisitions, M&A, fail miserably. In fact, the M&A efforts border on being laughable, though not to the hundreds of thousands of workers tossed out on the street when Mr. Big tries to justify the outrageous price he pays for an acquisition by slashing costs, invariably including R&D, and decimating payrolls. Hence, below you will simply find a small sample of evidence that adds up to a big blemish on the Biggie's records. I don't believe in economies of scale. You don't get better by being bigger. You get worse. Dick Kovacevich, retired CEO, Wells Fargo. Supporting the substance of the quote, Wells' growth for growth's sake strategy has in recent times badly backfired. For example, pushing too hard for revenue growth has led to egregious behavior toward its customers. Mr. Foster and his McKinsey colleagues collected detailed performance data stretching back 40 years for 1,000 large public U.S. companies. They found that none of the long-term survivors managed to outperform the market. Worse, the longer the companies had been in the database, the worse they did. The Financial Times. Re-listen. That is zero for 1,000. A rather poor batting average, eh? I am often asked by would-be entrepreneurs seeking escape from life within huge corporate structures, how do I build a small firm for myself? The answer seems obvious. Buy a very large one and just wait. Paul Omerod, economist, from Why Most Things Fail, Evolution, Extinction, and Economics. Funny, or is it? Multinational companies, the agents behind global integration, were already in retreat well before the populist revolts of 2016. Their financial performance has slipped so that they are no longer outstripping local firms. Many seem to have exhausted their ability to cut costs and taxes and to outthink their local competitors. Central to the rise of the global firm was its claim to be a superior money-making machine. That claim lies in tatters. The Economist, January 28, 2017. Cover story. The multinational company is in trouble. Almost every personal friend I have in the world works on Wall Street. You can buy and sell the same company 6 times and everybody makes money, but I'm not sure we're actually innovating. Jeff Immelt, former CEO, GE. Mr. Immelt's not sure, but I am. The innovation record of this sold and resold crowd is, to be kind, less than sterling. One senior Wall Street observer of the scene calls the wretched process by its true name, buy and cut. To Mr. Immelt's point, when recently asked to name just one big merger that had lived up to expectations, Leon Cooperman, former co-chairman of Goldman Sachs Investment Policy Committee, answered, I'm sure there are success stories out there, but at this moment I draw a blank. Mark Sirower, the synergy trap. Whoops, another zero. Not a single company that qualified as having made a sustained transformation ignited its leap with a big acquisition or merger. Moreover, comparison companies, those that failed to make a leap, or if they did, failed to sustain it, often tried to make themselves great with a big acquisition or merger. They failed to grasp the simple truth that while you can buy your way to growth, you cannot buy your way to greatness. Jim Collins, Time Magazine. The extensive research on large-scale mergers and acquisitions typically concludes that about 75% of the new combinations destroy value. I rest my case, certainly not the last word, but indeed a non-trivial sample of consistently damning evidence about giant corporation performance. 4.3.1. The real stars, mid-size niche dominators. Research shows that new small companies create almost all of the new private sector jobs and are disproportionately innovative. The future is small. Why AIM, alternative investment market, will be the world's best market beyond the credit boom, by Gervais Williams, superstar fund manager, reported in the Financial Times. most, almost all, the jobs, most of the innovation, and, to repeat, limited attention from policymakers or from me. 4.3.2. Be the best. George Whalen's book, Retail Superstars, Inside the 25 Best Independent Stores in America, chronicles 25 stellar acts of SME boldness and imagination. I give retail superstars as inspiration to accountants and HR directors, not just small business people. I've given away dozens and dozens of copies. Peerless examples of imagination at work. Big wins from smallish folks over the biggest of the big guys. It can be done. In addition to being attracted by the imagination component, I give the books away for a second reason, namely Whalen's stellar one-liner. Be the best. It's the only market that's not crowded. If ever there could be a condensed version of the SME credo, that's it. The Grateful Dead's late Jerry Garcia went even further than Whalen. You do not merely want to be the best of the best. You want to be considered the only ones who do what you do. 4.3.2.1. America's best restroom. Consider Jungle Jim's International Market in Fairfield, Ohio. Customers come from near, far, and very far to experience what the boss calls shoppertainment. Start with the food itself. Try a selection of 1,600 cheeses, 1,400 hot sauces, 12,000 wines from $8,000 to $8,000 a bottle. But in a way, the food is the least of it. The late Mr. Whalen went on to report, Jungle's creations literally jam-pack the store with visual surprises, in addition to the oasis filled with animals outside and the race car above the entrance, a 7-foot-high mechanized lion entertains shoppers by singing Elvis Presley's Jailhouse Rock. The Sherwood Forest display in English Foods comes complete with a talking Robin Hood. An antique boar's head truck hangs above the deli. A full-size rickshaw sits in Chinese Foods. Other delights include an Amish horse-drawn buggy in meats and Coney Island bumper cars filled with sweets in the candy department. The props can also be a bit bizarre. Two men's and women's porta-potties, situated in the front area of the store, look as though they belong on a construction site rather than in a food store, but they are false fronts. And once through the doors, customers find themselves in beautifully appointed restrooms. These creative facilities were recognized in 2007 as America's Best Restroom in the 6th annual competition sponsored by Cintas Corporation, a supplier of restroom cleaning and hygiene products. I am particularly taken with America's Best Restroom. There are many honors a business could get, including, for example, a Malcolm Baldrige National Quality Award, MBNQA, sometimes presented on the White House lawn by the president. But if I were a business owner in the appropriate market, I would prefer America's Best Restroom to a romp on the White House lawn. It speaks to imagination and customer care in a way that simply cannot be topped. FYI, before leaving the topic of restrooms, consider this Texas highway billboard. Only 262 miles to Buc-ee's. You can hold it. Or this one. Restroom so clean we leave mints on the urinals. Buc-ee's is a chain of Texas convenience stores and gas stations, the biggest in New Braunfels and considered the largest convenience store in America at 68,000 square feet, includes 120 fueling positions, 83 toilets, 31 checkout registers, and much more. And yes, the New Braunfels Buc-ee's won the 2012 contest for America's Best Restroom. Gotta love it. Excellence in New Braunfels is one more giant reminder of SME imagination on parade with the strangest damn features in the strangest damn places. Why I love my job. The day I drafted this, I unexpectedly received an email from a Brazilian who'd attended a seminar of mine. The email included four pictures of a glorious gas station restroom in Bauru, Brazil. The sender said he'd immediately thought of me in a lecture I'd given in Sao Paulo when he happened upon it. Excellence in Bauru. Excellence in restrooms. Yes! 4.3.2.2. Another retail superstar. Apt Electronics. An unbridled act of imagination and differentiation. Traditional electronics retailing is being killed by the internet, but there are brick-and-mortar exceptions. Here's another case study from Whalen's Retail Superstars. Established in 1936, family-owned Apt Electronics is still going strong, and in fact continuing to grow and prosper in the insanely competitive Chicagoland market. Below, in shorthand form, are a few of the things that make Apt stand out. Campus of 350,000 square feet, 37 acres. $300 million in revenue. Design center, classes on every damn thing. Destination, like a Kia. Restaurant, atrium with spectacular flowers, 7,500-gallon aquarium, etc. In-house delivery teams, spiffy uniforms, etc. Training in general, knowledge training. Staff treated exceptionally well, financially and otherwise. Yes, period, to the nuttiest customer requests. No excuses. Overstaffing. Merchandising, boats displaying marine electronics, cars with various systems, etc. Web fanatics, encyclopedic information regarding almost all stuff sold. Blog and live chat with live experts 24/7, etc. Rating of services, far above Home Depot, Lowe's, and so on. 4.3.3. Small giants. Companies that chose to be great instead of big. The section title is a book title from Inc. co-founder Bo Burlingham. He effectively wrote a companion piece to Whalen's Retail Superstars. Burlingham studied 14 companies. Their markets were typically very specialized. For example, Echo of Boise, Idaho, is the leading manufacturer of backup alarms and amber warning lights for commercial vehicles. Real Precision Parts Manufacturing of St. Paul, Minnesota, makes motion control products such as hinges used on the covers of laptop computers. These top performers dominated their specialty markets. Burlingham reports that the 14 shared four traits. 1. They cultivated exceptionally intimate relationships with customers and suppliers based on personal contact, one-on-one interaction, and mutual commitment to delivering on promises. 2. Each company had an extraordinarily intimate relationship with the local city, town, or county in which it did business, a relationship that went well beyond the usual concept of giving back. 3. The companies had what struck me as unusually intimate workplaces. 4. I noticed the passion that the leaders brought to what the company did. They loved the subject matter, whether it be music, safety lighting, food, special effects, constant torque hinges, beer, record storage, construction, dining, or fashion. 4 powerful success traits available to one and all. The list is at once mundane and inspiring and a winning marketplace formula and eerily consistent with George Whalen's findings. Let me single out the last point, the passion. That's near the top of the list of MIA among the typically bedraggled giants. Not fair. There typically is a passion for short-term results, but little desire to bag that America's Best Restroom trophy. 4.3.4. Hidden Champions of the 21st Century. Success Strategies of Unknown World Market Leaders. In Hidden Champions, Hermann Simon, generally considered Germany's number one management thinker, has given us another SME masterpiece. I carry it around with me, the hardback edition, and bang it loudly on podiums, growling, "Yes, you can." Oddball places, oddball and often so-called boring businesses, super-duper stars, repeat, collectively the backbone of all national economies. Here are a few